From the High Center Studios of Messiah College in the Shark Tank of Grantham, Pennsylvania, this is the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast, a bi-weekly discussion dedicated to American history, historical thinking, and the role of history in our everyday lives. And now, here's your host, author and award-winning historian, John Fia.
Thank you, Drew, and welcome to episode 21 of the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast. It is finally starting to get warm here at the Way of Improvement Leads Home headquarters. And when the weather finally starts to turn, it always gets me thinking about graduation and then preparing for the next school year. So what better time than now to turn our attention to the continued importance of the liberal arts in today's society?
Couldn't agree more, John. And I mean, to be fair, we've addressed this issue a bit on some previous episodes, coming at it from different directions, but today we're going to tackle it head on. We're going to break down the value of liberal arts and humanities education in a STEM-obsessed world.
Yeah, that's right, Drew. It makes sense, since I've been repeating both on the podcast and on the blog that we need good historical thinking now more than ever, especially as we go through this time of great political change and, dare I say, political danger that we're experiencing right now in the United States. I mean, think about it. We have a president whose only bona fides are running a business and who legitimates his power by saying that politics is broken and a heavy dose of corporate thinking is the way to fix it. You know, that's a really big claim, and it's one that I think we can debate in part by thinking historically.
I mean, I think getting an answer to this question is pretty important moving forward, and you bringing up the business side of our president's resume makes me think about all these think pieces that I keep seeing on the internet talking about how the left should respond to Trumpism by nominating Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, assuming that the problem is that Democrats have been too anti-corporate. I don't know about you, John, but I think that's pretty narrow thinking, and I relish the opportunity to throw my hat for us to throw our hat into the discussion. But we shouldn't be limiting the conversation just to contemporary politics. I think you know better than most that the humanities is a field of undergraduate studies in crisis. I know that as someone who hopefully will be looking for a job here in the field soon. But at the same time, I know in your work on the blog and as a chair of a history department, you haven't given up or become fatalistic.
Yeah, well, I must admit that I have had my moments of fatalism, Drew. Anyone who reads the Way of Improvement Leads Home blog, you know, just go back and read the blog in the months, June, July, the fall of 2016. I was pretty down in the dumps about the fate of the humanities in American life. And then by extension, you know, the fate of the kind of enduring questions about human flourishing and what makes a good society that the study of the humanities always raise. You know, but I think I'm slowly starting to come out of the funk. I was on sabbatical last year. I've gotten back into the classroom. The classroom always gives me hope. I just came back from a trip from a liberal arts college up in New England, Gordon College on Boston's North Shore. I gave a lecture on why history and the humanities is essential to our democratic life here in the United States. And, you know, I come back encouraged by some of the feedback I got from students, by some of the faculty up there at this New England Liberal Arts College. And I think I'm becoming more encouraged again about the possibilities. I think if there's a silver lining in the Trump election, it's the way it has mobilized historians, humanists, and just the liberal arts community generally to articulate what they are all about and why they are significant. Again, for those of you who read the blog, I just wrote a post the other day, a very popular post, actually, one of the more popular posts of the last month or so, about the revival of the history major at Yale University. History is now the most popular major among the Yale class of 2019. Popular, again, who thought, you know, how many places can say history is the most popular major? So this is very encouraging news. It seems as if young people and maybe even their parents are starting to come around to the idea that history, the study of history, the humanities are desperately needed in our culture today. So again, very, very good news here.
Yeah. And you know, I think that extends just, I mean, beyond just the culture, American culture and the well-informed citizen. You know, while I admittedly have stuck with academia since getting my BA, that wasn't my initial intention. I came here to Messiah and decided to study the liberal arts because I thought it was a great way for me to learn how to think critically and then go into a totally different field. But, you know, and I'm sure you brought this up, one of the biggest issues for you is simply getting new students to declare themselves as history majors.
Yeah, of course. And we're actually going to talk about this today with our guests. I've worked hard to try to get my students, their parents, and even the history community at large, through the blog, through speaking, and so forth, to celebrate students who major in history or another humanities or liberal arts discipline, and then go on to use their skills that they learn in all kinds of jobs and vocations, not just the sort of history profession. I think too often history departments tend to celebrate the students who go off to grad school, and you know, they kind of we celebrate the ones who become just like us, right, who become professors. But those who pursue a professional career in history represent a small number of graduates, history majors. I read somewhere that most history majors actually go to work in the business world. These are the stories we need to celebrate if we want to make the study of history compelling to high school students and even undeclared students. And speaking of new students picking a major, Drew, we have a bonus guest in the studio today.
That we do. But before we turn to her, I do want to mention that our work here wouldn't be possible without the generous donations of Lisa DeGuardi and Ron Schooler, along with many, many other patrons. If you are interested in supporting our work here at the Way of Improvement Leads Home, consider joining our Patreon campaign. Simply go to thewayofimprovement.com and click support. We still have plenty of pledge goodies to give away.
And we will continue to have them.
Yes. But as regular listeners may also know, this is the time when we usually announce our official sponsor, Jennings College Consulting. However, today we have the brains behind that operation, Dr. Peggy Jennings herself, here in the studio. We thought, what better episode than this to bring on our official business partner to talk about her work. But before we turn to Peggy, we do have a small confession. Dr. Jennings is more than just a business partner. In fact, calling her Peggy is a little weird for me, as I know her as Mom. That being said, her work pairs very nicely with what we are doing here on the podcast, so it just simply made sense to make the partnership more official.
Absolutely, Drew. We have our sponsor in the studio. Peggy Jennings is here. Welcome to the podcast, Peggy.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, let's start with your own education and experience, because I have to say your experience is pretty extensive.
Well, thank you. I started my career in college student affairs and did residence life, freshman orientation, academic advising, academic support. My most recent position was associate dean at Dickinson College.
Right.
But then I took sort of a shift and then spent the next 15 years as a high school gifted support teacher, which involves mostly helping gifted students plan for college, but also adapting their high school curriculum for their needs. But the last 2.5, 3 years, I've been a private consultant specializing in college admissions. Educationally, I have my bachelor's from DePaul University in Indiana, where I majored in history. I have a master's in counseling from Miami University in Ohio, and my doctorate is from Indiana University in Indiana in higher education. And I'm also one of 300 certified educational planners in the country.
Wonderful. So a history major.
Yes.
Right? At a great liberal arts school. We're just talking about that off air here. About DePaul. So what do you do at Jennings College Consulting? Tell us about your work there.
Well, the college admissions process has gotten increasingly complex, increasingly expensive, and very high stakes. And while school counselors are wonderful, hardworking people, they are often overwhelmed with caseloads that run as many as 100 or 200 students. So for some families, they would like a little bit extra help and support in the process. So I can provide in-depth, personalized support for families. I work with fewer than 25 students at a time. We start very early. We meet often. I can meet with parents. I can meet in the evenings and on weekends and support students as they go and their parents as they go through that process.
I do want to get specific to what we're doing here. How would you advise a bright student interested in history or philosophy or some other humanities field, who are, you know, maybe hesitant about going into one of these disciplines because they're not sure they can do anything with it or something like that? Even the parents, right? How would you advise the parents, you know, to go into one of these fields, realizing they're footing the bill for a lot of money, especially if they're at a liberal arts college or a private institution? What advice would you give? Because I deal with this every day, right? Trying to convince kids to major in history. Mm-hmm. Give me some help.
Well, I think there's a very clear distinction between education and training. And studying in the humanities and more broadly in the liberal arts, can really give students, I think, a more comprehensive and nuanced view of the world as it is now and as it was. The human condition doesn't change that much over the centuries. What changes is the context and the specifics of what's going on. And of course, you know, students and parents are worried about their students spending the money and getting a job. More and more colleges, and especially liberal arts colleges, are using internships and summer programs to help students get that kind of technical or specific training that they might need to move more easily into a particular job. Students, we know, are going to change their mind multiple times. They're going to change careers multiple times. And I think they're more valuable if they're well-educated first. We know that technical companies, companies that deal with engineers and technicians, are crying out for employees who are well-educated and that they can then train for their specific needs, but whose basic background has been to be broadly educated.
Let's get to the nitty-gritty here. If our listeners are either high school age students or more likely parents with high school age students, how might they hire you to help with the college selection process? Where do we find you?
Well, first of all, I'd encourage them to start early. Freshman and sophomore year of high school is not too soon to be able to do good long-range planning, but they can find me on my webpage. They can Google Jennings College Consulting, or the web address is drj4college.com. I will provide a free one-hour consultation either in person or by video conference for anyone who just wants to find out what I do and whether working together makes sense for them. I'd be delighted to talk with them.
Excellent. Peggy, we thank you every other week here at the podcast for your support of what we're doing here. Now I am privileged to thank you in person for supporting us. It was great to have you with us here today.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Okay. Before my mom starts pulling out baby pictures, you have a story for us, John.
In 2013, then U.S. Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, who at the time was the ranking Republican member of the Senate Budget Committee, raised issues about a National Endowment for the Humanities program called Enduring Questions. This program provided grants to university professors who wanted to develop courses based around such questions as, what is the meaning of life? And what is the good life? And how do I live it? Sessions was also bothered that the National Endowment for the Humanities granted professors funds to study Islam. At the time, Sessions believed that taxpayer money should not be used to support subjects related to questions that are quote-unquote indefinite, or that favor one religion over another. The House of Representatives Budget Committee agreed with Sessions. In its fiscal 2014 budget resolution, the committee called for a complete elimination of funding for the National Endowment for the Humanities based on the belief that the federal government should not be in the business of supporting humanities-based research. In the end, the committee let the National Endowment for the Humanities live, but elected to slash its budget by 49%. Lest one think that the failure of politicians and political leaders to see the importance of the humanities to American life is only a Republican thing, it is worth noting that President Barack Obama was no friend of this kind of learning and thinking. When it came to education funding, President Obama always threw his weight behind the so-called STEM disciplines, science, technology, engineering, and math. He ended the funding for the Teaching of American History grants, which was a program from the Department of Education that infused school districts with millions of dollars for the purpose of strengthening the teaching of our shared past. And he even argued that some liberal arts degrees, he specifically mentioned art history, offered poor preparation for the job market. And now we enter the age of Trump. In March 2017, Trump issued his first federal budget plan. It eliminates, among other things, the National Endowment for the Humanities. Practically speaking, the National Endowment for the Humanities operates on a minuscule budget of $148 million. That represents 0.003% of federal spending in 2016. Apparently, our president thinks that this money would be better used to pay for a massive border wall or the buildup of what is already the largest and most powerful military in the world history. Trump, it seems, wants the government to get out of the business of funding projects that might lead to compassion for those such as refugees and immigrants and others who may be in need. It should alarm us that Trump prefers spending more money on fighter jets than he does on research that might bring peaceful and humane solutions to global problems. The National Endowment for the Humanities was created by the National Foundation on the Arts and the Humanities Act and was signed into law by Lyndon Johnson in 1965. Several things are worth noting about this act. First, it affirmed that an advanced civilization must not limit its efforts to science and technology alone, but must also support, quote, great branches of scholarly and cultural activity in order to achieve a better understanding of the past, a better analysis of the present, and a better view of the future, unquote. Second, it affirmed that, quote, democracy requires wisdom and vision in its citizens, unquote, and must provide citizens with education and access to the arts and the humanities in order to, quote, make people of all backgrounds and wherever located masters of their technology and not its unthinking servants, unquote. Third, it affirmed that the arts and humanities reflect Americans' respect for the nation's rich cultural heritage and foster respect for our country's vast diversity. And fourth, it affirmed that, quote, the world leadership which has come to the United States cannot rely solely upon superior power, wealth, and technology, but must be solidly founded upon worldwide respect and admiration for the nation's high qualities as a leader in the realm of ideas and of the spirit, unquote. Perhaps Donald Trump has not read the text of this important act, or perhaps he has read it and simply does not care. I have seen two basic but ultimately unconvincing arguments for eliminating the National Endowment for the Humanities. The first argument suggests that American society does not need the humanities, rejecting the entire philosophy behind the 1965 act that created the National Endowment. Trump wants to eliminate an agency that will help our democracy to thrive. The humanities cultivate the pursuit of truth and evidence-based arguments, empathy for the views of others, civic understanding, and an awareness that we are members of a human community that is larger than ourselves or our current moment in time. The second argument against the National Endowment for the Humanities is made by libertarian-leaning politicians who appreciate what the humanities bring to United States society, but do not think that the federal government should be in the business of promoting them. I would be sympathetic to this argument if I believed that private and corporate interests would step up with the money necessary to support the humanities and the cultural institutions that bring them to life for millions of Americans. Our shared culture and traditions are constantly evolving and changing to meet the needs of the people who invoke them. The preservation and reinterpretation of these traditions and the democratic virtues that come with such activity need support. Do we really want to trust the treasured traditions, stories, and markers of our collective or group identities to a capitalist market that is driven predominantly by the pursuit of profit at all cost? The grand stories of our national identity have a good chance of surviving under such privatization. We will continue to hear, read, and learn about Gettysburg, Paul Revere, women's suffrage, and Martin Luther King Jr. But what will happen to our ability to tell the local and regional stories that have given meaning to life in small places? Who will fund the work of telling stories of everyday world changers who have been forgotten because they do not conform easily to our national narratives? Can we rely on those in the private sector to care about the experience a child might have at a small museum or historical site? An experience that could change her life and reorient her way of seeing the world? In Donald Trump's America, study and reflection on these kinds of things do not matter. We may be on the brink of a cultural holocaust, and we all have a responsibility to prevent it from happening. Make America great again.
Scott Hartley is a venture capitalist and author. He has served as a presidential innovation fellow at the White House, a partner at Moore David Dow Ventures, and a venture partner at Metamorphic Ventures. Prior to venture capital, Scott worked at Google, Facebook, and Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. He has been a contributing author at MIT Press and has written for the Financial Times, Forbes, Inc., Foreign Policy, and the Boston Review. His newest book, The Fuzzy and the Techie, Why the Liberal Arts Will Rule the Digital World, is available April 25th, 2017.
Our guest today on the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast is Scott Hartley, the author of a brand new book, The Fuzzy and the Techie, Why the Liberal Arts Will Rule the Digital World. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So tell me a little bit more, our audience are mostly people who are interested in history, right? So tell me a little bit more about yourself, your work. You know, some of our audience may not even be familiar with what a venture capitalist or a global startup advisor even does. So, you know, what do you do for a living? What is your day-to-day experience like in the marketplace?
These are great questions. Venture capital is effectively, it provides early stage startup risk capital to companies that are trying to get off the ground. Typically, you know, the way venture capital works is you're part of a fund, and a fund is made up of a number of, limited partners or different pension funds, university endowments, maybe high net worth individuals or family offices that contribute into a fund. And then that pool of capital is managed by a few people. And they effectively meet with startups and entrepreneurs thinking about different business ideas, different ways to, quote unquote, disrupt markets. And, they meet with a number of those people, and they think through where they think the market is going, what's been tried before, what may or may not work. They really sort of base an investment decision around the team and the idea and the market size. And then they make a small investment in that team, and then they basically work with those entrepreneurs through the process of creating a company. Helping them figure out sort of the best uses of capital, maybe their hiring timeline, you know, how to best allocate the resources to try different things and test hypotheses. If that's successful, you know, many companies go out of business. So it's sort of you create a portfolio of different companies that you work with that may or may not be, you know, in different sectors around the economy. It's a very exciting ability to kind of sit at a 60,000 foot view over Silicon Valley or over the startup landscape and think about, you know, what's happening in machine learning, what's happening in artificial intelligence or in the Internet of Things, or in how tech is, say, disrupting fashion or media or finance. So there are any number of ways that you can kind of be involved in the space. My particular past 5 or so years has been, you know, working with different early stage technology companies that are, going after applying tech to different sectors. And that's really where I had the idea for this book. It came out of an observation that I had looking around Silicon Valley, which is a place where, you know, I've spent the last 20 or 25 years, and realizing that sort of the trends of the 1990s, where I think technologists were laying down the groundwork and the infrastructure for the internet and for sort of the technological revolution that we have today, they were really laying the groundwork. And I think at that time there was really a requirement that you be kind of deeply technical to play in that world. And over time, I think, you know, as we've moved into this sort of application layer of the technology, my observation looking around Silicon Valley was many of the people that were pitching our firm were people coming out of these various backgrounds and walks of life people with different academic backgrounds. You know, people, for example, Steve Case, who founded AOL, he's actually a history major from Williams College. So, you know, you take kind of a step back and you look at who some of these sort of quote unquote technological innovators are, and they're people just like you and me, you know, coming from all different backgrounds, all different walks of life. Sure. And it's really more about the problem that they've uncovered and how they want to, you know, apply that technology.
Yeah, we want to get into that here in a second. Actually, Drew, I think this is our first guest who's ever described himself as a market disruptor.
Yeah.
I like that. You know, I really like the idea of kind of the 60,000 foot view, right? We historians can kind of relate to that, right? Trying to get a bigger picture on things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's get right to the meat of your book. Who are the techies and who are the fuzzies?
Right. So this term, the fuzzies and the techies, this term is actually something that I didn't make up, but it stems from a reference on Stanford campus and kind of the heart of Silicon Valley. I think it dates back to the 1960s or 1970s on campus, where people would kind of lightheartedly ask, you know, are you a fuzzy or are you a techie? Yeah. Do you study sort of the hard sciences and the engineering world, the computer sciences, or do you study, you know, the arts, the humanities, and the social sciences? And it's sort of this this lighthearted moniker of, you know, calling somebody a techie versus calling somebody a fuzzy. It really goes back, you know, talking about history to a guy named Charles Percy Snow, who gave a great lecture in 1959 at Cambridge University. And in this lecture, which was dubbed sort of the Two Cultures Lecture, he threw down this idea that, you know, we had this false, this sort of faux opposition between the sciences and the humanities, between these two sides of the same coin, and how really, you know, it was incumbent upon all of us to make sure that, you know, somebody who studies the laws of thermodynamics also reads Shakespeare, and somebody who reads, you know, James Joyce might also learn some JavaScript. And so, you know, kind of as we think through these two sides, it's less about, you know, one versus the other, fuzzies versus techies, you know, whether you're one or the other. And it's more about really the blurring lines between these two worlds. Because I think, you know, if you look around Silicon Valley or you look around what's happening in academia as well, it's really hard to say, you know, somebody who studies history or economics or political science is quote unquote fuzzy, you know, has no hard skills, and somebody who studies mechanical engineering is somehow, you know, only techie. Because really, if you look at, you know, the trends in mechanical engineering, for example, you know, the work of David Kelly and Tim Brown and some of the people behind IDEO, famous kind of design firm, design thinking has really come to the forefront in, you know, the engineering world, which is, you know, bringing the sort of soft sides of design and psychology to mechanical engineering, you know. And then you look at something like political science, where statistical modeling has become huge, you know, or game theory is prevalent in economics. So, you know, those subjects have become heavily quantified, where, you know, maybe engineering has become softer. So it's really kind of less about one versus the other, and it's more about how it's really blending these two sides kind of creates the confluence of things that lead to innovation.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that you bring that up, because I know in conversations and historical training, I'm still in graduate school, big data is a big popular thing to discuss in historical work, and how can we use some of the technologies that enable us to analyze large amounts of data to change the way we write our historical narratives, which I think would be a great example of tech kind of bleeding into historical scholarship.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one idea there, just kind of on the topic of big data, which is something that I unpack in one of the chapters in the book, sort of thinking about the, you know, is data going to suddenly lead to this end of this kind of emergence of knowledge just by itself, and sort of the end of hypotheses. And, you know, and this is something that's gone back to Plato and to Sir Francis Bacon. Sure. There's a guy at Oxford University, Luciano Floridi, who wrote a great book a few years back where he sort of, you know, myth busts this idea and says, you know, in 2008, Chris Anderson, who wrote a great piece for Wired called sort of it wasn't the end of history, but it was sort of the end of, wasn't Francis Fukuyama, but sort of the end of hypotheses.
Yeah.
You know, the end of something, right? There's always the end of something. Right. And really said, you know, you know, wait a minute, you know, even if we have, you know, the cost of sensors has come down, there's sensors everywhere, you know, on our bodies, in our buildings, in our cars, you know, even if we're creating all of this data, all of this information, what is it that turns data and information into knowledge? And really it's about people asking questions of the data. You know, it's applying a hypothesis to the data, really kind of testing and iterating. So I think this is something that, you know, as much as we hear about the rise of big data and the rise of artificial intelligence and all these things, kind of taking a step back, you know, remembering that, you know, in and of themselves, these ones and zeros, you know, don't have any objective truth. And these are still things that require massaging and asking questions of. And, you know, there's a great quote, which I'll paraphrase and kind of, you know, attributed to Voltaire, about, you know, judge a man by his questions, not by his answers. Right. And I think, you know, more and more in the future, we're going to have machines generating data, machines bringing things to the attention of humans, but humans really required to ask the deep questions of those, you know, of those data.
Yeah, which machines can't do, right? Let's get a little biographical here, maybe for you, autobiographical. You describe yourself in the book, or in materials I read, as a fuzzy living in a techie world. Elaborate that on that for us a little bit, because it's I'd love to hear, you know, how you navigate this as a fuzzy in a techie world. You know, tell us a little bit about your kind of personal journey, your intellectual history, your training that makes you say that about yourself.
Yeah, I guess I've always, you know, like you and probably like a number of listeners of this podcast, you know, I went to a liberal arts school and I studied political science. I really had sort of a deep desire, maybe because of a lack of classical education in high mm-hmm. school, where I really sought sort of the fundamentals of what I thought to be kind of a classic liberal education. So I studied, you know, Greek history and Roman history and Egyptian history, and I studied ancient and medieval and modern political theory, and I got my degree in political science, political theory, and did another degree in grad school on that. I got like somewhat pragmatic at one point when I was fearful of debt, and I said, well, maybe I should do an MBA too, which is actually, you know, double wrong.
Right.
You know, it's in Silicon Valley, graduating any program is to the detriment of your credibility in the entrepreneurial world. So those were kind of my academic training was through political science and international relations, international economic policy in grad school. But all in all, you know, I had the fortune of growing up in the Bay Area in kind of the heart of Silicon Valley and seeing the boom and the bust of the Valley. And so, you know, I think I always had this mixture of digital and analog and of you know, things and devices, and really having an interest in the real world things. Like, for example, I've worked with my father, and I've built an entire Martin guitar from scratch. Wow. So out of piles of wood, not from a kit, but literally taking about 100 hours woodworking, building a guitar from scratch. And there's just a real process and a real appreciation for kind of the physicality of things. And so I guess I've, you know, as much as I've spent time at Google and Facebook and these, you know, these big tech companies, in my personal life, you know, I subscribe to the print edition of the Financial Times. I was always the one guy on the Google shuttle with the salmon paper, you know, like hitting somebody in the face with the paper, and everyone looked at me and they said, you know, can't you just get an iPad? You know, what's your problem? And for me, there is sort of a raw discovery, I guess, of kind of fumbling your way through the paper. And, you know, as much as I love Flipboard and various types of, you know, online consumption and how you can navigate through an iPad, there's just something about the physical paper that I still appreciate. So I think, you know, in those ways, I definitely define myself as more of a fuzzy than a techie. But at the same time, like I said before, you know, it's really about kind of the confluence of these two sides, because obviously, you know, through economics or political science training, you're exposed to a lot of different, you know, you're using statistical software, or maybe you take a class in Java, or you do something that's quote unquote techie. But really, I think as far as how I identify myself, you know, I always saw myself on that side of the equation. Sure. Versus the other. You know, and if you look around the Valley, you know, from from Steve Jobs to many individuals, it's often sort of this pairing of the two. You know, for every Woz, there's a Jobs, and for every Mark Zuckerberg, there's a Sheryl Sandberg. And so I think you know, one of the premises of the book is that you can really be either of these sides, you know, however you identify. And the truth is that we blend both.
It's funny you bring that up. My sister works over at Instagram, and whenever she comes to visit me, you know, she always rolls her eyes when she gets in the car with me because I'm fumbling through all of these CDs, because I still like to buy all my music in a kind of physical form because of how much of a multimedia experience it is, you know, reading through the liner notes as well as putting the CD, you know, the tactile act of putting the CD in a CD player. But
see, for me, it's the CD, you know, any CD kind of tells a story, right?
Exactly.
You miss the... Yeah.
Yeah, and it forces you to think about it within the boundaries of a single album. So I hear you, Scott.
Now, Scott, if I read your book correctly, let's sort of dive into the central thesis here. And you've already touched on this a little bit. If I read your book correctly, you argue that the business world has bought into a false narrative, namely that it's the techies that are the real drivers of innovation. I know you've talked about this already, but elaborate on that false narrative a little bit more, because I find too, and we'll get to this too in a few minutes, but I find that most, you know, most parents I encounter as a college professor have also bought into a kind of false narrative about, you know, what one can do with a liberal arts degree or what one actually can't do, they think, with a liberal arts degree. So tell me about this false narrative that the business world has that you know, really is, I think, at the heart of your book.
Yeah, happy to. So, I mean, I think, you know, coming from, again, taking it with sort of my own N of one, you know, personal perspective from this, you know, coming out of Silicon Valley, where I think there are, you know, people presume it to be this sort of walled garden filled with dropout coders and, you know, quote unquote programmers, you know, a bunch of bros living in houses together, you know, coding all night, eating pizza. And while that, you know, that absolutely exists, you know, I think there's sort of this perpetuation of, kind of the lionization of the techie, you know, is kind of what I call it. And, you know, whether it's, you know, Mark Andreessen, who founded Netscape and is a fantastic venture capitalist at the helm of Andreessen Horowitz, you know, he comes out on balance at the end of the day. And I think he probably largely doesn't fully disagree with the premise of my book. But, you know, he has been quoted as saying things like, you know, the soft skills, you know, people with soft skills are going to work in shoe stores in the future. You know, Vinod Khosla, who is a co-founder of Sun Microsystems and also is now at the helm of another VC firm called Khosla Ventures, you know, he's written Medium pieces about the liberal arts being useless. You know, I think everyone thinks of Mark Zuckerberg, for example, as this, you know, amazing programmer.
Right.
And you kind of forget the backstory of, you know, while he obviously is an amazing programmer, that's sort of table stakes in some sense. But what really gave him the competitive advantage and the edge, I think, is that, you know, he had that, plus he had this sort of background and appreciation and curiosity honed at, you know, Exeter, where he went to, you know, liberal arts prep school, and he read ancient Greek and Latin and Hebrew and French. He actually won a prize at Exeter for classical studies. You know, he's broader than I think people give him credit for. Obviously, he's gone on to learn Chinese. So, you know, really like a fantastically curious individual, probably, you know, honed through this process of breadth of exposure. And I think, so getting at the heart of, you know, what are the liberal arts? And I think there's this false narrative about, you know, liberal arts means unemployed, you know, English major barista and,
yeah,
this struggling, you know, theater arts major. And really, if you take a step back, you know, the liberal arts, in the kind of classical sense, actually incorporate mathematics, they incorporate the natural sciences like biology and physics and astronomy, you know, so they're not just kind of, you know, basket weaving on one side and people that are technical on the other side. And so I think kind of getting back to what do they actually mean? Well, you know, they're mislabeled as soft. And like we talked about before, you know, if you study history and, you know, political science and these various things, there is a massive element of quantitative rigor to those. So one, you know, they're not fully soft. And then two, you know, I think that they really incorporate all these different ideas. And the whole premise is to kind of tug on the mind and challenge assumptions and get people to learn to think and challenge their own biases. You know, and when we look to a world in the future where, you know, data and artificial intelligence and all these things are kind of bringing things to the forefront, the biggest requirement of us is to kind of question and be curious and question biases and sort of and push back on what's told to us. You know, these are all things that are kind of classically trained, I think, in a liberal arts setting. Yeah. And so, you know, that's sort of the premise of it. And you know, if you look at sort of this false narrative of being techies as the drivers of innovation, you know, there is absolutely still a major role for, you know, for techies to lay infrastructure in new areas with you know, kind of throughout this ecosystem. I think what's really profound today, though, is that the chunks, the tools have become more democratized than ever. Mm. And these chunks are becoming larger and larger so that you can kind of assemble pre-assembled pieces. So for example, if you look at even an app like Uber, that's, you know, massively complex, you know, under the hood, Uber is made up of, you know, 10 or 20 different services. So Uber doesn't build its own payment system. They probably use a payment platform. You know, Uber doesn't, build their own, you know, API, for example, to send notifications to your phone when your car is about to arrive. They use a service called Twilio to do that. Mm-hmm. So there are all these pre-assembled blocks that they're calling upon to build this, you know, more and more complicated platform. And so I think, you know, as those blocks get bigger and bigger, and as programming becomes more and more abstracted away from learning this really specialized syntax, and it becomes closer and closer to natural language in English, actually what becomes really powerful is the ability to ask these questions, not sort of the ability to have command over a certain syntax. You know, so to take like an example out of, you know, look at Google Translate, you know, while it's still, you know, it's still really important, and there's major value for people who are fluent in Russian or fluent in a specific language. Mm-hmm. Google Translate gives us all sort of the rough cut ability to, you know, interact in those different mediums. And so I think in the same way, you know, as these building blocks become more accessible to people, people have the ability to kind of interact in these different worlds. And then it becomes more about how we apply those technologies to useful problems. Sure. And so that's really where I think breadth of exposure in the liberal arts and breadth of exposure to different domains gives us the context for how we actually might want to apply the code. And I think that becomes sort of this real advantage in, you know, and what drives innovation. So many of these companies that I was seeing sitting in the venture capital seat were, you know, there were techies in the room, to be sure. But, you know, many times the CEO or many times the founder was somebody who had come out of a particular walk of life, come out of a different academic background, had a real understanding of a problem. And, you know, the kind of biggest barrier to entry and starting a company wasn't access to a programmer to code the tech. It was, you know, having an idea that was worth pursuing and a problem that was big enough to go after.
Right.
Wait, so let's follow up on that a little bit. And you brought up some of the liberal arts skills honed by Mark Zuckerberg, and you referenced some of these unnamed techies in some of these venture capital meetings. But can you give us an example of a you know, maybe a product that we're really familiar with that wouldn't be where it is if it were not for liberal arts thinking and leaders who are trained in the liberal arts?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a surprising number of examples, like I mentioned. And I think that was the premise of, you know, or I guess the impetus to write the book was, you know, wait a minute, this narrative that, you know, everyone in Silicon Valley and this walled garden is deeply technical and that's what's giving them their ability to play in this world. You know, and I would visit cousins of mine in, you know, in Colorado or in Boise, Idaho, or different parts of America. And they'd say, it's so cool that you're, you know, part of Silicon Valley. I could never really do anything there because I'm not technical. Mm. And that was sort of this aha moment to me, was like, wait a minute. Absolutely. You know, all of us can participate in this world. And actually, as these building blocks become more accessible, it becomes more and more incumbent upon us to involve this diversity of background and diversity of thought into how we build our tech. So just, you know, quick pan around Silicon Valley. And when I refer to Silicon Valley, I mean kind of technology writ large, because in many you know, in many parts of the country, this is flourishing. You know, but Sheryl Sandberg, obviously at Facebook, she was an economics major. Mm-hmm. Susan Wojcicki, who runs YouTube, studied history and literature. You know, Carly Fiorina, who used to be at the helm of HP. She was a medieval history major.
That's right. I knew that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Alex Karp, who's the CEO of a big data company called Palantir. He actually has a PhD in neoclassical social theory.
Wow.
So, I mean, talk about, you know, probably an esoteric subject that people would mostly say, well, what's the use of studying that? Well, obviously, you know, he found broad application and sort of participating in a data science company like Palantir. But then, you know, it's not just people at the helm in sort of management roles. And that's one of the things that I wanted to bring to the surface too. It's actually the product visionaries behind a lot of these companies. So, you know, from Reid Hoffman, who founded LinkedIn, who, you know, was a philosophy major,
mm-hmm.
To Peter Thiel, who founded PayPal, he also studied philosophy and kind of founded it under almost like a libertarian premise. You know, and then Stuart Butterfield is a great example, the founder of Slack, which is a kind of a more modern technology people may or may not be familiar with. But Slack is sort of seeking to make email redundant. It's a corporate communications platform.
Huh.
But through the process of creating Slack, Stuart Butterfield's actually been, you know, quoted as saying what gave him the product clarity of kind of figuring out. Because Slack actually was, it was a product feature in another company that he had started that failed. And he realized through the process of that failure that the company itself should be around Slack, should be around this corporate communications function that they had developed. And the clarity of pursuing that was what he attributed to his training in philosophy of kind of peeling back the onion and getting closer and closer to this idea of truth. And you kind of keep pursuing, you keep questioning, you keep pulling back. And eventually you kind of arrive at something that more or less seems true and real. And that's sort of how they uncovered this sort of kernel that became the genesis of Slack, which is now, you know, a multi-billion dollar company.
Right.
So those are just a few examples, you know, but
yeah.
Pinterest, that Ben Silberman, who founded Pinterest, is a political science major. The list just goes on and on. And so I think, you know, that's interesting to look at who's at the helm of these companies. And then there's another... You know, there's sort of another angle where you can look at within these companies, how are we involving, you know, people from the liberal arts and what do those roles kind of look like? You know, I'm happy to talk about that a bit too.
Yeah, I noticed reading about how it seemed to be a kind of informal or maybe non-technical kind of survey of LinkedIn that you did. And you had a chart which, you know, if I remember correctly, it was like a third of the people who work at Google have sort of liberal arts majors, or it was like 32% or something like that. And I was just shocked to see the numbers of employees at these places that did have liberal arts degrees.
Yeah. So, I mean, in full caveat to my yeah. non-techie.
Right. Non-sociological.
Yeah, a rough, you know, rough sketch.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I would love, you know, to engage your podcast listeners and people that may be listening to do this on their own. But I think that there's a ripe social science potential project in sort of pulling, for example, LinkedIn data to look at the breakdown across these roles and functions of different backgrounds and how people are contributing.
Right.
You know, and really the need. And so in my really rough sketch, you know, late night research, between 35% and roughly 52% I found at different companies.
Wow.
Based on pulling different university data, look to be from backgrounds that at least according to this sort of Stanford definition of fuzzy and techie,
yeah.
Would fall in those two categories. Which is surprising, you know,
that
to
is.
A lot of people. And I think, but to people, you know, sitting in Silicon Valley, they might roll their eyes at me and say, well, you know, of course they're, you know,
yeah,
they're,
sure.
My friend's an anthropology major and she runs, you know, the corporate communications department at Slack or,
right.
or whatever it might be. But I think if you look at, you know, sort of the prevalence of this technology and how deeply it touches our lives, it becomes, you know, more and more important that we ask these questions of who's in the room when these product decisions are being made,
right.
And how are we thinking through the applications of this tech? Because, for example, one person I feature in the book, his name is Tristan Harris. And Tristan, he sold his company to Google and then became, he sold his startup to Google and then became what he called the in-house product philosopher. And this was sort of a self-created title. And he went around campus and he asked questions of product managers, and he brought the Buddhist philosopher Thich Nhat Hanh to campus to talk to product managers. And he sort of brought these questions to people's minds of, you know, is our tech still what Steve Jobs called a bicycle for the mind, or has it really become a slot machine in our pocket?
Yeah.
You know, and you think about your always on device in your pocket, how there are very few number of people in very few companies, mostly in Silicon Valley, mostly Caucasian males, probably in their 20s and 30s, making product decisions that have the impact of massive scale. For probably one of the first times in human history, you can touch a billion people with one product decision. You know, and so how is this having an impact on people's lives? You know, Linda Stone, who was previously an executive at Apple and spent time at MIT, you know, she talks about a concept of kind of semi-sync or continuous partial attention, where all of us are, you know, maybe having a conversation, but then our phone buzzes and we check Instagram and our phone buzzes again and we send a text. And we have this sort of frequency of interruption that is variable. And because of it's sort of a variable reward, you know, B.F. Skinner and sort of psychology would tell us, well, this becomes pretty addictive pretty fast. And so really, you know, Tristan likens our phones in our pockets to, you know, slot machines and what, you know, instead of a one-armed bandit, it's kind of become a one-fingered bandit where, you know, with the swipe of a finger, you can get this this dopamine hit and this stimulus. So, you know, how are we thinking about these types of questions? Who's in the room when that's happening?
Sure.
Should there be, you know, an FDA? Should there be a food pyramid? Should there be design standards? Should there be, you know, a way that we think about the same way that you walk up into Starbucks and you can order a Frappuccino versus a black coffee, but you know, you also see that the Frappuccino has 400 calories and the black coffee has 80 calories, and you can make a decision, but at least you're sort of privy to, you know, what that decision entails.
Yeah. Yeah. Drew, your sister works at Instagram. You mentioned, and she was a creative writing.
Right. When your book came across our desk and we were interested in having you on, I also knew in the back of my mind that I kind of already believed your thesis because my, you know, my sister is a founding content strategist at Instagram and was a creative writing major. So very much, I've heard this story before, around the Thanksgiving table.
You know, as I'm listening to Scott talk too, we need, you know, every corporation like this should have an in-house historian.
Absolutely.
Or an in-house humanist. Again, it's that seat on the table, right, Scott, that's important because it brings just a completely different way of thinking to the whole conversation.
Yeah, resume available upon request.
Yeah. Well, our time is just about up here. But I would be remiss if I didn't ask you one sort of practical question that's kind of near and dear to my heart. I'm going to put you on the spot here. Make a case, okay, to a parent as to why their child might forego a sort of business degree or a computer science degree or computer science or business major for a liberal arts degree or liberal arts major. I am someone who spends a lot of time, the last 15 years of my life, basically trying to recruit high school students into the humanities. So I could use all the help I can get on this one. But make that pitch for me. Teach me how to make that pitch.
All right. Well, I'll give it my best shot.
Good.
Well, so, you know, going back to the premise of the book, you know, I think it's less about making the argument of should you be technical or should you be not technical, right? We all know that in our future world, you know, data and access to technology and, you know, fluency with technology is hugely important. So I think number one is it's to have the notion that when you finish college or you finish, you know, high school, college, grad school, whatever it is for you, that your education is not capped at that moment and you don't have sort of this carte blanche, you know, hall pass to non-redundancy for the rest of your life. It's more about thinking that your education is always in beta. And that's an engineering term for thinking that, you know, your education is always a work in progress. And so thinking about kind of these modular steps of what, you know, what we should learn at the beginning, you know, I think we should learn to think, to be passionate about ideas, to be creative, to be sort of exposed to a broad swath of different disciplines, to kind of tug on our mind. I think, in my mind, that's a liberal arts background with exposure additionally to, technical literacy. So I think that if we can think about, could we teach engineering in a Socratic way, or could we teach ethics related to decisions in machine learning? Could we blend sort of what the questions of autonomous vehicles in urban environments are going to look like, and talk about, Kantian versus deontological, or versus consequentialist ethical frameworks? Can we think about these, apply philosophy, apply, history, through some of the, mediums of today? And so, I would say, in sort of making this case, look at what the world could potentially look like in the year 2050 or 2060. If you're graduating today, that world is going to look fundamentally different. And I think that we don't have any clue, what that's going to be. There's so much hype around artificial intelligence and automation taking over. There's an Oxford study that said 47% of U.S. jobs are at high risk of automation. McKinsey, the consulting firm, came out with a study in January that said actually only 5% of jobs are fully automatable, and technological capability is only this first step. There's obviously adoption. There's, capital stock turnover. If you're talking about vehicles, there's all these things that will happen that as this transition will take place over time. But I think what we can be confident of, looking forward many years, is that we're going to have an interaction between technology and human.
Yeah.
And so McKinsey makes the point, looking at 800 jobs, that 30% of tasks within roughly 60% of those jobs could be automated, could be scripted to some degree where they could be programmed. And so actually, if you look at, for example, a business major, where maybe you learn accounting, maybe you learn how to audit, do bookkeeping, things like that, these are actually the more scriptable tasks. These are actually the things that can be more easily programmed. If you look at, I think they said something around 86% of auditing and bookkeeping in the retail sector, for example, is something that could be done. Additionally, if you look at wealth management or something that's even kind of up the stack in the finance world, robo advisors are really taking over a lot of those types of jobs, are really helping supplement people as they give guidance on, for example, where to invest in the stock market.
Right.
So really what becomes more and more important and more prevalent in this future world is the ability to ask questions, right? The ability to kind of have this exposure to ideas, to be able to interface with technology, to be able to interface with people. And so I think to the degree that we can kind of keep our educations in beta, not rest on our laurels, try to upskill and be fluent as much as we can with the technological tools, but also kind of ground it in this exposure to a broad set of ideas and a broad set of passions and curiosity. I really think that that's where we kind of come out on balance with, with the liberal arts.
Yeah, good advice. I'm taking notes here as you're talking. Hey, Scott, this has been a great, fascinating conversation. And it's a conversation I think we've been wanting to have for a while here since we started the podcast. But thank you so much for taking some time. Tell us a little bit how to get your book, where we can find more about you. Do you have a website?
Yeah, so the website, you can go to fuzzytechie.com.
I love it.
And the book is more or less sold most places that books are sold. So I'd say, whether it's Barnes & Noble or Amazon or any, pick your favorite.
And are you heading out on a tour or anything like that?
Yeah, I'm based in Brooklyn, New York at the moment, but it will be in Seattle and San Francisco, Denver, Colorado, Chicago, right. Boston. So it'll be all over the place.
We can get those dates from the website?
Yeah, I have a Facebook group as well. That's just facebook.com/fuzzytechie.
Okay.
And that's where I'm posting most of the events and various things that we're doing.
Well, get out there, folks, and get this book, The Fuzzy and the Techie, Why Liberal Arts Will Rule the Digital World. We've been talking with the author of that book, Scott Hartley. Scott, thanks again for your time.
Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, thank you. Chat. Drew, that was certainly a different kind of interview for the podcast, but a very revealing and fascinating one.
Yeah, I think it's important that we, obviously using a digital medium here to broadcast our ideas, we need to continue to have these conversations with the tech world, or else, you know, we're just preaching to the choir.
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about this all episode, but I'd love to, like, sort of clone Scott. How about that for a humanities thing, right? It reminds me of the poster I have up in my office. Science can teach us how to clone a Tyrannosaurus Rex, but the humanities might tell us that it's a bad idea, right? But if we could clone Scott, which, you know, the humanities tells us may not be a good idea, but if we could, right, for a second, I'd love to bring him into these meetings I have with parents when I try to sell them on the history major and how the history major can lead you to all kinds of different places, including the Silicon Valley, right?
Absolutely. Well, and lest we put the blame on parents who are scared to foot the bill for a history major, I mean, we need to learn as historians working in teaching and working with students, we need to learn that our goal, as you mentioned at the top of the episode, is not to make little professors, but actually to prepare people through robust liberal arts education to be very versatile in a rapidly changing job market. And, you know, she came up in the interview. My sister majored in creative writing at a small liberal arts school. And the reason she has proven successful is because she didn't get limited by her dreams of being a wonderful poet, although she is. She's a fabulous poet. But she went on, got internships, and really grinded and figured out how that creative writing education was applicable to the tech world. And now, well, I'm a grad student, and she's got a big position in the Silicon Valley.
Well, Drew, it's kind of like you, right? You know, I mean, you're studying history, but at the same time, your real career is, once we make it big, is going to be the producer of the greatest podcast in the world.
Let's hope. my sister would call this my side hustle.
Your side? No. We're going to make this center to your vocation here.
Main hustle. Let's make this the main hustle.
The main hustle. I like that. No, this has been a conversation, like I said, we've been waiting to have for a while. And it's been really, really fun having family day for you here, Drew, today, right? We got your sister referenced. We got your mom coming in and talking a little bit, our first kind of sponsor who comes into the studio. So I think it's been a great episode.
Absolutely. And I think this is a conversation we should keep continuing. Hey, if you're on social media, you like this episode, give it a retweet. Give it a dedicate a post. Talk about your favorite part, and help spread the word, because I mean, that's really what matters here. Is we need to be telling more and more people why the liberal arts matters. We need to put pressure on our politicians to continue to fund the liberal arts and fund the humanities, fund the arts, right? You know, it's not just the NEH, the National Endowment for the Humanities, that's under the axe. These things are really important for who we are. And so your work now, as listeners and as supporters of the humanities and as supporters of the podcast, is to continue to make your voices heard. And sometimes it's as easy as a retweet.
Or head over to the Patreon site and help us out even more. We could really use it as we try to keep this thing going. I guess that's a wrap then, Drew.
Absolutely.
Well, I hope everybody enjoyed this episode. Hope you learned something today. And as usual, may your way of improvement always lead home.
This has been a production of The Way of Improvement Leads Home, a blog dedicated to reflections at the intersection of American history, religion, politics, and academic life. Visit us at thewayofimprovement.com. This episode is brought to you through the generous support of Lisa DeGuardi, Ron Schooler, and our sponsor, Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. We also want to thank David Onion for his support. If you want to support our efforts, please rate and review us on iTunes or Stitcher so others may more easily find this podcast. The podcast was recorded at the High Center Studios on campus at Messiah College. Thanks to Ed Ark for his continued support. Original music is by Overholt. Many thanks to our guest, Scott Hartley. Our studio producer is Josh Lowry. I've been your producer, Drew Dearley-Hermeling, and your host, as always, is John Fia.
When When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.